are finding and give them to your spouse. Don't wait for a special occasion. If receiving gifts is his or her primary love language, almost anything you give will be received as an expression of love. If she has been critical of your gifts in the past and almost nothing you have given has been acceptable, then receiving gifts is almost certainly not her primary love language. The best investment. If you are to become an effective gift giver, you may have to change your attitude about money. Each of us has an individualized perception of the purposes of money, and we have various emotions associated with spending it. Some of us have a spending orientation. We feel good about ourselves when we are spending money. Others have a saving and investing perspective. We feel good about ourselves when we are saving money and investing it wisely. If you are a spender, you will have little difficulty purchasing gifts for your spouse. But if you are a saver, you will experience emotional resistance to the idea of spending money as an expression of love. You don't purchase things for yourself. Why should you purchase things for your spouse? But that attitude fails to recognize that you are purchasing things for yourself. By saving and investing money, you are purchasing self-worth and emotional security. You are caring for your own emotional needs in the way you handle money. What you are not doing is meeting the emotional needs of your spouse. If you discover that your spouse's primary love language is receiving gifts, then perhaps you will understand that purchasing gifts for him or her is the best investment you can make. You are investing in your relationship and filling your spouse's emotional love tank, and with a full love tank, he or she will likely reciprocate emotional love to you in a language you will understand. When both persons' emotional needs are met, your marriage will take on a whole new dimension. Don't worry about your savings. You will always be a saver. But to invest in loving your spouse is to invest in blue-chip stocks. The gift of self. There is an intangible gift that sometimes speaks more loudly than a gift that can be held in one's hand. I call it the gift of self, or the gift of presence. Being there when your spouse needs you speaks loudly to the one whose primary love language is receiving gifts. Jan once said to me, "My husband Don loves softball more than he loves me." "Why do you say that?" I inquired. "On the day our baby was born, he played softball. I was lying in the hospital all afternoon while he played softball," she said. "Was he there when the baby was born?" "Oh, yes. He stayed long enough for the baby to be born. But 10 minutes afterward, he left to play softball. I was devastated. It was such an important moment in our lives. I wanted us to share it together. I wanted him to be there with me. Don deserted me to play." That husband may have sent her a dozen roses, but they would not have spoken as loudly as his presence in the hospital room beside her. I could tell that Jan was deeply hurt by that experience. The baby was now 15 years old, and she was talking about the event with all the emotion as though it had happened yesterday. I probed further. "Have you based your conclusion that Don loves softball more than he loves you on this one experience?" "No," she said. "On the day of my mother's funeral, he also played softball."
"Did he go to the funeral?"
"Yes, he did. He went to the funeral, but as soon as it was over, he left to play softball. I couldn't believe it. My brothers and sisters came to the house with me, but my husband was playing softball." Later, I asked Don about these two events. He knew exactly what I was talking about. "I knew she would bring that up," he said. "I was there through all the labor, and when the baby was born, I took pictures. I was so happy. I couldn't wait to tell the guys on the team, but my bubble was burst when I got back to the hospital that evening. She was furious with me. I couldn't believe what she was saying. I thought she would be proud of me for telling the team. And when her mother died, she probably did not tell you that I took off work a week before she died and spent the whole week at the hospital and at her mother's house doing repairs and helping out. After she died and the funeral was over, I felt I had done all I could do. I needed a breather. I liked to play softball, and I knew that would help me relax and relieve some of the stress I'd been under. I thought she would want me to take a break. I had done what I thought was important to her, but it wasn't enough. She has never let me forget those 2 days. She says that I love softball more than I love her. That's ridiculous." He was a sincere husband who failed to understand the tremendous power of presence. His being there for his wife was more important than anything else in her mind.
Physical presence in the time of crisis is the most powerful gift you can give if your spouse's primary love language is receiving gifts. Your body becomes the symbol of your love. Remove the symbol and the sense of love evaporates. In counseling, Don and Jan worked through the hurts and misunderstandings of the past. Eventually, Jan was able to forgive him, and Don came to understand why his presence was so important to her. If the physical presence of your spouse is important to you, I urge you to verbalize that to your spouse. Don't expect him to read your mind. If, on the other hand, your spouse says to you, "I really want you to be there with me tonight, tomorrow, or this afternoon," take his request seriously. From your perspective, it may not be important, but if you are not responsive to that request, you may be communicating a message you do not intend. A husband once said, "When my mother died, my wife's supervisor said that she could be off 2 hours for the funeral, but she needed to be back in the office for the afternoon. My wife told him that she felt her husband needed her support that day, and she would have to be away the entire day. The supervisor replied, 'If you're gone all day, you may well lose your job.' My wife said, 'My husband is more important than my job. She spent the day with me. Somehow that day, I felt more loved by her than ever before. I have never forgotten what she did.' Incidentally," he said, "she didn't lose her job. The supervisor soon left, and she was asked to take his job." That wife had spoken the love language of her husband, and he never forgot it. Miracle in Chicago. Almost everything written on the subject of love indicates that at the heart of love is the spirit of giving. All five love languages challenge us to give to our spouse. But for some, receiving gifts, visible symbols of love, speaks the loudest. I heard the most graphic illustration of that truth in Chicago, where I met Doug and Kate. They attended my marriage seminar and agreed to take me to O'Hare Airport after the seminar on Saturday afternoon. We had 2 or 3 hours before my flight, and they asked if I would like to stop at a restaurant. I was famished, so I readily assented. Kate began talking almost immediately after we sat down. She said, "Dr. Chapman, God used you to perform a miracle in our marriage. 3 years ago, we attended your marriage seminar here in Chicago for the first time. I was desperate," she said. "I was thinking seriously of leaving Doug and had told him so. Our marriage had been empty for a long time. I'd given up. For years, I had complained to Doug that I needed his love, but he never responded. I loved the children, and I knew they loved me, but I felt nothing coming from Doug. In fact, by that time, I hated him. He was a methodical person. He did everything by routine. He was as predictable as a clock, and no one could break into his routine. For years," she continued, "I tried to be a good wife. I did all the things I thought a good wife should do. I had sex with him because I knew that was important to him, but I felt no love coming from him. I felt like he stopped dating me after we got married and simply took me for granted. I felt used and unappreciated. When I talked to Doug about my feelings, he'd laugh at me and say we had as good a marriage as anybody else in the community. He didn't understand why I was so unhappy. He would remind me that the bills were paid, that we had a nice house and a new car, that I was free to work or not work outside the home, and that I should be happy instead of complaining all the time. He didn't even try to understand my feelings. I felt totally rejected." "Well, anyway," she said, as she moved her tea and leaned forward, "we came to your seminar 3 years ago. I did not know what to expect, and frankly, I didn't expect much. I didn't think anybody could change Doug. During and after the seminar, he didn't say too much. He seemed to like it. He said that you were funny, but he didn't talk with me about any of the ideas in the seminar. I didn't expect him to, and I didn't ask him to. Then, that Monday afternoon, he came home from work and gave me a rose. 'Where did you get that?' I asked. 'I bought it from a street vendor,' he said. 'I thought you deserved a rose.' I started crying. 'Oh, Doug, this is so sweet of you.' On Tuesday, he called me from the office at about 1:30 and asked me what I thought about his buying a pizza and bringing it home for dinner. He said he thought I might enjoy a break from cooking dinner. I told him I thought the idea was wonderful, and so he brought home a pizza, and we had fun together. The children loved the pizza and thanked their father for bringing it. I actually gave him a hug and told him how much I enjoyed it. When he came home on Wednesday, he brought each of the children a box of Cracker Jacks, and he had a small potted plant for me. He said he knew that Rose would die, and he thought I might like something that would be around for a while. I was beginning to think I was hallucinating. I couldn't believe what Doug was doing or why he was doing it. Thursday night after dinner, he handed me a card with a message about his not always being able to express his love to me, but hoping that the card would communicate how much he cared. "Why don't we get a babysitter on Saturday night and the two of us go out for dinner?" he suggested. "That would be wonderful," I said. On Friday afternoon, he stopped by the cookie shop and bought each of us one of our favorite cookies. Again, he kept it as a surprise, telling us only that he had a treat for dessert. By Saturday night, she said, I was in orbit. I had no idea what had come over Doug, or if it would last, but I was enjoying every minute of it. After our dinner at the restaurant, I said to him, Doug, you have got to tell me what's happening. I don't understand. She looked at me intently and said, Dr. Chapman, you have to understand, this man had never given me a flower since the day we got married. He never gave me a card for any occasion. He always said, it's a waste of money. You look at the card and throw it away. We'd been out to dinner one time in 5 years. He never bought the children anything and expected me to buy only the essentials. He had never brought a pizza home for dinner. He expected me to have dinner ready every night. I mean, that was a radical change in his behavior. I turned to Doug and asked, what did you say to her in the restaurant when she asked you what was going on? I told her that I had listened to your lecture on love languages at the seminar and that I realized that her love language was gifts. I also realized that I had not given her a gift in years, maybe not since we had been married. I remembered that when we were dating, I used to bring her flowers and other small gifts, but after marriage, I figured we couldn't afford that. I told her that I decided that I was going to try to get her a gift every day for 1 week and see if it made any difference in her. I had to admit that I had seen a pretty big difference in her attitude during the week. I told her that I realized that what you said was really true and that learning the right love language was the key to helping another person feel loved. I said I was sorry that I had been so dense all those years and had failed to meet her need for love. I told her that I really loved her and that I appreciated all the things she did for me and the children. I told her that with God's help, I was going to be a gift giver for the rest of my life. She said, but Doug, you can't go on buying me gifts every day for the rest of your life. You can't afford that. Well, maybe not every day, I said, but at least once a week. That would be 52 more gifts per year than what you have received in the past 5 years. Doug continued, and who said I was going to buy all of them? I might even make some of them, or I'll take Dr. Chapman's idea and pick a free flower from the front yard in the spring. I don't think he's missed a single week in 3 years, Kate said. He's like a new man. You wouldn't believe how happy we've been. Our children call us lovebirds now. My tank is full and overflowing. I turned to Doug and asked, but what about you, Doug? Do you feel loved by Kate? Oh, I've always felt loved by her, Dr. Chapman. She's the best housekeeper in the world. She's an excellent cook. She's wonderful about doing things with the children. I know she loves me. He smiled and said, now you know what my love language is, don't you? I did, and I also knew why Kate had used the word miracle. Gifts need not be expensive, nor must they be given weekly. But for some individuals, their worth has nothing to do with the monetary value and everything to do with love. Your turn. Reflect on ways to give gifts to one another, even if the finances are tight. If your spouse's love language is receiving gifts, let me share some suggestions. Number one, try a parade of gifts. Leave a box of candy for your spouse in the morning. Have flowers delivered in the afternoon. Give him a gift in the evening. And when your spouse says, what is going on? You respond, just trying to fill your love tank. Number two, let nature be your guide. The next time you take a walk through the neighborhood, keep your eyes open for a gift for your spouse. It may be a stone, a stick, or a feather. You may even attach special meaning to your natural gift. For example, a smooth stone may symbolize your marriage with many of the rough places now polished. A feather may symbolize how your spouse is the wind beneath your wings. Number three, discover the value of homemade originals. Make a gift for your spouse. This may require you to enroll in a class, ceramics, silversmithing, painting, wood carving, and so forth. Your main purpose for enrolling is to make your spouse a gift. A handmade gift often becomes a family heirloom. Number 4. Give your spouse a gift every day for 1 week. It need not be a special week, just any week. I promise you, it will become the week that was. If you are really energetic, you can make it the month that was. No, your spouse will not expect you to keep this up for a lifetime. Number 5. Keep a gift idea notebook. Every time you hear your spouse say, "I really like that," write it down in your notebook. Listen carefully, and you will get quite a list. This will serve as a guide when you get ready to select a gift. To prime the pump, you could look through a favorite online shopping site together. Number 6. Enlist a personal shopper. If you really don't have a clue as to how to select a gift for your spouse, ask a friend or family member who knows your wife or husband well to help you. Most people enjoy making a friend happy by getting them a gift, especially if it's with your money. Number 7. Offer the gift of presents. Say to your spouse, "I want to offer you the gift of my presence at any event or on any occasion that you would like this month. You tell me when, and I'll make every effort to be there. Get ready. Be positive. Who knows? You may enjoy the symphony or the hockey game." 8. Give your spouse a book and agree to read it yourself. Then offer to discuss together a chapter each week. Don't choose a book that you want him or her to read. Choose a book on a topic in which you know your spouse has an interest. Sex, football, needlework, money management, child rearing, religion, backpacking. Number 9. Give a lasting tribute. Give a gift to your spouse's church or favorite charity in honor of her birthday, your anniversary, or another occasion. Ask the charity to send a card informing your spouse of what you have done. The church or charity will be excited, and so will your spouse. Number 10. Give a living gift. Purchase and plant a tree or flowering shrub in honor of your spouse. You may plant it in your own yard, where you can water and nurture it, or with permission in a public park or forest where others can also enjoy it. You will get credit for this one year after year. Chapter 7. Love Language Number 4. Acts of Service. Michelle sat in the living room, pecking away at the laptop. She could hear sounds from the utility room where her husband Brad was catching up with the piles of laundry. She smiled to herself. In recent days, Brad had cleaned the condo, fixed supper, and run the errands, all because Michelle was in the midst of finals for grad school. It made her feel content, loved. Michelle's primary love language was what I call acts of service. By acts of service, I mean doing things you know your spouse would like for you to do. You seek to please her by serving her, to express your love for her by doing things for her. So it was with Doug, whom we met in the last chapter. Such actions as cooking a meal, setting a table, washing dishes, vacuuming, cleaning a commode, changing the baby's diaper, dusting the bookcase, keeping the car in operating condition, paying the bills, trimming the shrubs, walking the dog, changing the cat's litter box, and dealing with landlords and insurance companies are all acts of service. They require thought, planning, time, effort, and energy. If done with a positive spirit, they are indeed expressions of love. Conversation in a mill town. I discovered the impact of acts of service in the little village of China Grove, North Carolina. China Grove sits in central North Carolina, originally nestled in chinaberry trees, not far from Andy Griffith's legendary Mayberry, and an hour and a half from Mount Pilot. At the time of this story, China Grove was a textile town with a population of 1,500. I had been away for more than 10 years, studying anthropology, psychology, and theology. I was making my semi-annual visit to keep in touch with my roots. Almost everyone I knew, except Dr. Shin and Dr. Smith, worked in the mill. Dr. Shin was the medical doctor, and Dr. Smith was the dentist. And, of course, there was Preacher Blackburn, who was a pastor of the church. For most couples in China Grove, life centered on work and church. The conversation at the mill focused on the superintendent's latest decision and how it affected their job in particular. The services at church focused mainly on the anticipated joys of heaven. In that pristine American setting, I discovered love language number 4. I was standing under a chinaberry tree after church on Sunday when Mark and Mary approached me. I didn't recognize either of them. I assumed they had grown up while I was away. Introducing himself, Mark said, "I understand you have been studying counseling." I smiled and said, "Well, a little bit." "I have a question," he said. "Can a couple make it in a marriage if they disagree on everything?" It was one of those theoretical questions that I knew had a personal root. I brushed aside the theoretical nature of his question and asked him a personal question. "How long have you been married?" 2 years, he responded, "and we don't agree on anything." "Give me some examples," I continued. "Well, for one thing, Mary doesn't like me to go hunting. I work all week in the mill, and I like to go hunting on Saturdays. Not every Saturday, but when the hunting season is in." Mary had been silent until this point when she interjected, "When hunting season is out, he goes fishing. And besides that, he doesn't hunt just on Saturdays. He takes off from work to go hunting." "Once or twice a year, I take off 2 or 3 days from work to go hunting in the mountains with some buddies. I don't think there's anything wrong with that." "What else do you disagree on?" I asked. "Well, she wants me to go to church all the time. I don't mind going on Sunday morning, but Sunday night, I like to rest. It's all right if she wants to go, but I don't think I ought to have to go." Again, Mary spoke up. "You don't really want me to go either," she said. "You fuss every time I walk out the door." I knew that things weren't supposed to be getting this hot under a shady tree in front of a church. As a young, aspiring counselor, I feared that I was getting in over my head. But having been trained to ask questions and listen, I continued, "What other things do you disagree on?" This time Mary answered. "He wants me to stay home all day and work in the house," she said. "He gets mad if I go see my mother or go shopping or something." "I don't mind her going to see her mother," he said. "But when I come home, I like to see the house cleaned up. Some weeks, she doesn't make the bed up for 3 or 4 days, and half the time, she hasn't even started supper. I work hard, and I like to eat when I get home. Besides that, the house is a wreck," he continued. "The baby's things are all over the floor. The baby is dirty, and I don't like filth. She seems to be happy to live in a pig pen. We don't have very much, and we live in a small mill house, but at least it could be clean." "What's wrong with his helping me around the house?" Mary asked. "He acts like a husband shouldn't do anything around the house. All he wants to do is work and hunt. He expects me to do everything." Thinking that I had better start looking for solutions rather than prying for more disagreements, I looked at Mark and asked, "Mark, when you were dating, before you got married, did you go hunting every Saturday?" "Most Saturdays," he said. "But I always got home in time to go see her on Saturday night. Most of the time, I'd get home in time to wash my truck before I went to see her. I didn't like to go see her in a dirty truck." "Mary, how old were you when you got married?" I asked. "I was 18," she said. "We got married right after I finished high school. Mark graduated a year before me, and he was working." "During your senior year in high school, how often did Mark come to see you?" I inquired. "He came almost every night," she said. "In fact, he came in the afternoon and would often stay and have supper with my family. He would help me do my chores around the house, and then we'd sit and talk until supper time." "Mark, what did the two of you do after supper?" I asked. Mark looked up with a sheepish smile and said, "Well, the regular dating stuff, you know." "But if I had a school project," Mary said, "he'd help me with it. Sometimes we worked hours on school projects. I was in charge of the Christmas float for the senior class. He helped me for 3 weeks every afternoon. He was great." I switched gears and focused on the third area of their disagreement. "Mark, when you were dating, did you go to church with Mary on Sunday nights?" "Yes, I did," he said. "If I didn't go to church with her, I couldn't see her that night. Her father was strict that way." I thought I was beginning to see some light, but I wasn't sure Mark and Mary were seeing it. I turned to Mary and asked, "When you were dating Mark, what convinced you that he really loved you? What made him different from other guys you had dated?" "It was the way he helped me with everything," she said. "He was so eager to help me. None of the other guys ever expressed any interest in those things, but it seemed natural for Mark. He even helped me wash dishes when we had supper at our house. He was the most wonderful person I'd ever met. But after we got married, that changed. He didn't help me at all." Turning to Mark, I asked, "Why do you think you did all those things for her and with her before you were married?" "It just seemed natural for me," he said. "It's what I would want someone to do for me if she cared about me." "And why do you think you stopped helping her after you got married?" I asked. Well, I guess I expected it to be like my family. Dad worked, and Mom took care of those things at the house. I never saw my dad vacuum or wash the dishes or do anything around the house. Since Mom didn't work outside the house, she kept everything spotless, did all the cooking, washing, and ironing. And I guess I just thought that was the way it was supposed to be. Hoping that Mark was seeing what I was seeing, I asked, "Mark, a moment ago, what did you hear Mary say when I asked her what really made her feel loved by you when you were dating?" He responded, "Helping her with things and doing things with her." So can you understand how she could feel unloved when you stopped helping her with things? He was nodding yes. I continued, "It was a normal thing for you to follow the model of your mother and father in marriage. Almost all of us tend to do that. But your behavior toward Mary was a radical change from your courtship. The one thing that had assured her of your love disappeared." Then I turned to Mary and asked, "What did you hear Mark say when I asked, 'Why did you do all of these things to help Mary when you were dating?'" "He said that it came naturally to him," she replied. "That's right," I said. "And he also said that is what he would want someone to do for him if she loved him. He was doing those things for you and with you because in his mind, that's the way anyone shows love. Once you were married and living in your own house, he had expectations of what you would do if you loved him. You would keep the house clean, you would cook, and so on. In brief, you would do things for him to express your love. When he did not see you doing these things, do you understand why he would feel unloved?" Mary was nodding now, too. I continued, "My guess is that the reason you are both so unhappy in your marriage is that neither of you is showing your love by doing things for each other." Mary said, "I think you're right, and the reason I stopped doing things for him is because I resented his demanding spirit. It was as if he was trying to make me be like his mother." "True," I said, "and no one likes to be forced to do anything. In fact, love is always freely given. Love cannot be demanded. We can request things of each other, but we must never demand anything. Requests give direction to love, but demands stop the flow of love." Mark broke in and said, "She's right. I was demanding and critical of her because I was disappointed in her as a wife. I know I'd said some cruel things, and I understand how she could be upset with me." "I think things can be turned around rather easily at this juncture," I said. I pulled out two note cards out of my pocket. "Let's try something. I want each of you to sit on the steps of the church and make a request list. Mark, I want you to list three or four things that if Mary chose to do them, would make you feel loved when you walk into the house in the afternoon. If making the bed is important to you, then put it down. Mary, I want you to make a list of three or four things that you would really like to have Mark's help in doing. Things that, if he chose to do them, would help you know that he loved you." I'm big on lists. They force us to think concretely. After 5 to 6 minutes, they handed me their list. Mark's list read, "Make up the beds every day. Have the baby's face washed when I get home. Put her shoes in the closet before I get home. Try to have supper at least started before I get home so that we could eat within 30 to 45 minutes after I get home." I read the list out loud and said to Mark, "I'm understanding you to say that if Mary chooses to do these four things, you will view them as acts of love toward you." "That's right," he said. "If she did those four things, it would go a long way in changing my attitude toward her." Then I read Mary's list. "I wish she would wash the car every week instead of expecting me to do it. I wish she would change the baby's diaper after he gets home in the afternoon, especially if I'm working on supper. I wish he would vacuum the house for me once a week. I wish he would mow the grass every week in the summer and not let it get so tall that I'm ashamed of our yard." I said, "Mary, I'm understanding you to say that if Mark chooses to do these four things, you would take his actions as genuine expressions of love toward you." "I would," she said. "It would be wonderful if he would do those things for me." "Does this list seem reasonable to you, Mark? Is it feasible for you to do these things?" "Yes," he said. "Mary, do the things on Mark's list seem reasonable and feasible to you? Could you do them if you chose to?" "Yes," she said, "I can do those things. In the past, I have felt overwhelmed because no matter what I did, it was never enough." I turned to Mark. "Mark, you understand that what I'm suggesting is a change from the model of marriage that your mother and father had. Oh, my father mowed the grass and washed the car, but he didn't change the diapers or vacuum the floor, right?" "Right," he said. You don't have to do these things, you understand. If you do them, however, it will be an act of love to Mary. And to Mary I said, you understand that you don't have to do these things, but if you want to express love for Mark, here are four ways that will be meaningful to him. I want to suggest that you try these for 2 months and see if they help. At the end of 2 months, you may want to add additional requests to your list and share them with each other. I would not add more than one request per month, however. This really makes sense, Mary said. I think you've helped us, added Mark. They took each other by the hand and walked toward their car. I said to myself out loud, I think this is what church is all about. I think I'm going to enjoy being a counselor. I have never forgotten the insight gained under that chinaberry tree. After years of research, I have realized what a unique situation Mark and Mary presented to me. Seldom do I meet a couple who both have the same love language. For both Mark and Mary, acts of service was their primary love language. Hundreds of individuals can identify with either Mark or Mary and acknowledge that the primary way that they feel loved is by acts of service on the part of their spouse. Putting away shoes, changing a baby's diaper, washing dishes or a car, vacuuming or mowing speaks volumes to the individuals whose primary love language is acts of service. You may be wondering, if Mark and Mary had the same primary love language, why were they having so much difficulty? The answer lies in the fact that they were speaking different dialects. They were doing things for each other, but not the most important things. When they were forced to think concretely, they easily identified their specific dialects. For Mary, it was washing the car, changing the baby's diaper, vacuuming the floor, and mowing the grass. Whereas for Mark, it was making up the bed, washing the baby's face, putting the shoes in the closet, and having supper underway when he got home from work. When they started speaking the right dialects, their love tanks began to fill. Since acts of service was their primary love language, learning each other's specific dialect was relatively easy for them. Before we leave Mark and Mary, I would like to make 3 other observations. First, they illustrate clearly that what we do for each other before marriage is no indication of what we will do after marriage. Before marriage, we are carried along by the force of the in-love obsession. After marriage, we revert to being the people we were before we fell in love. Our actions are influenced by the model of our parents, our own personality, our perceptions of love, our emotions, needs, and desires. Only one thing is certain about our behavior. It will not be the same behavior we exhibited when we were caught up in being in love. That leads me to the second truth illustrated by Mark and Mary. Love is a choice and cannot be coerced. Mark and Mary were criticizing each other's behavior and getting nowhere. Once they decided to make requests of each other rather than demands, their marriage began to turn around. Criticism and demands tend to drive wedges. With enough criticism, you may get acquiescence from your spouse. He may do what you want, but probably it will not be an expression of love. You can give guidance to love by making requests. I wish you would wash the car, change the baby's diaper, mow the grass. But you cannot create the will to love. Each of us must decide daily to love or not to love our spouses. If we choose to love, then expressing it in the way in which our spouse requests will make our love most effective emotionally. There is a third truth which only the mature lover will be able to hear. My spouse's criticisms about my behavior provide me with the clearest clue of her primary love language. People tend to criticize their spouse most loudly in the area where they themselves have the deepest emotional need. Their criticism is an ineffective way of pleading for love. If we understand that, it may help us process their criticism in a more productive manner. A wife may say to her husband after he gives her a criticism, "It sounds like that is extremely important to you. Could you explain why it is so crucial?" Criticism often needs clarification. Initiating such a conversation may eventually turn the criticism into a request rather than a demand. Mary's constant condemnation of Mark's hunting was not an expression of her hatred for the sport of hunting. She blamed hunting as the thing that kept him from washing the car, vacuuming the house, and mowing the grass. When he learned to meet her need for love by speaking her emotional love language, she became free to support him in his hunting. Doormat or lover? I have served him for 20 years. I have waited on him hand and foot. I have been his doormat while he ignored me, mistreated me, and humiliated me in the front of my friends and family. I don't hate him. I wish him no ill, but I resent him, and I no longer wish to live with him. That wife has performed acts of service for 20 years, but they have not been expressions of love. They were done out of fear, guilt, and resentment. A doormat is an inanimate object. You can wipe your feet on it, step on it, kick it around, or whatever you like. It has no will of its own. It can be your servant, but not your lover. When we treat our spouses as objects, we preclude the possibility of love. Manipulation by guilt, "if you were a good spouse, you would do this for me," is not the language of love. Coercion by fear, "you will do this or you will be sorry," is alien to love. No person should ever be a doormat. We may allow ourselves to be used, but we are in fact creatures of emotion, thoughts, and desires, and we have the ability to make decisions and take action. Allowing oneself to be used or manipulated by another is not an act of love. It is, in fact, an act of treason. You are allowing him or her to develop inhumane habits. Love says, "I love you too much to let you treat me this way. It is not good for you or me." Learning the love language of acts of service will require some of us to re-examine our stereotypes of the roles of husbands and wives. These are changing, but models from our past can linger. Mark was doing what most of us do naturally. He was following the role model of his father and mother. But he wasn't even doing that well. His father washed the car and mowed the grass. Mark did not. But that was the mental image he had of what a husband should do. He definitely did not picture himself vacuuming floors and changing the baby's diaper. To his credit, he was willing to break from his stereotype when he realized how important it was to marry. That is necessary for all of us if our spouse's primary love language asks something of us that seems inappropriate to our role. Due to the sociological changes of the past 40 years, we no longer cling to certain notions of the male and female role in American society. Yet, that does not mean that all stereotypes have been eradicated. It means, rather, that the number of stereotypes has multiplied. Before the days of widespread media influence, a person's idea of what a husband or wife should do and how he or she should relate was influenced primarily by one's own parents. With the pervasiveness of television, increased mobility, growing cultural diversity, and the proliferation of single-parent families, however, role models are often influenced by forces outside the home. Whatever your perceptions, chances are your spouse perceives marital roles somewhat differently than you do. A willingness to examine and change stereotypes is necessary in order to express love more effectively. Remember, there are no rewards for maintaining stereotypes, but there are tremendous benefits to meeting the emotional needs of your spouse. Recently, a wife said to me, "Dr. Chapman, I'm going to send all of my friends to your seminar." "And why would you do that?" I inquired. "Because it has radically changed our marriage," she said. "Before the seminar, Bob never helped me with anything. We both started our careers right after college. It was always my role to do everything at the house. It was as if it never crossed his mind to help me with anything. After the seminar, he started asking me, 'What can I do to help you this evening?' It was amazing. At first, I couldn't believe it was real, but it has persisted for 3 years now. I'll have to admit, there were some trying and humorous times in those early weeks because he didn't know how to do anything. The first time he did the laundry, he used undiluted bleach instead of regular detergent. Our blue towels came out with white polka dots. Then there was the first time he used the garbage disposal. It sounded strange, and shortly afterward, soap bubbles started emerging from the drain of the adjoining sink. He didn't know what was happening until I turned the garbage disposal off, reached my hand inside, and retrieved the remains of a new bar of soap, now the size of a quarter. But he was loving me in my language, and my tank was filling up. Now, he knows how to do everything around the house and is always helping me. We have much more time together because I don't have to work all the time. Believe me, I have learned his language, and I keep his tank full." Is it really that simple? Simple? Yes. Easy? No. Bob had to work hard at tearing down the stereotype with which he had lived for 35 years. It didn't come easily, but he would tell you that learning the primary love language of your spouse and choosing to speak it makes a tremendous difference in the emotional climate of a marriage. Now, let's move on to love language number 5. Your turn. Many acts of service will involve household chores, but not all. What are some non-chore ways of serving your mate? If your spouse's love language is acts of service, let me give you some suggestions. Number 1, make a list of all the requests your spouse has made of you over the past few weeks. Select one of these each week and do it as an expression of love. Number 2, print note cards with the following. Today, I will show my love for you by. Complete the sentence with one of the following. Picking up the clutter, paying the bills, fixing something that's been broken a long time, weeding the garden. Bonus points if it's a chore that's